so punctual after this. And Pat will be talking about things.
Yeah, right. So, thank you very much. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's the second time I've been here. And kind of
getting
equally fascinated and terrified. and I must apologise because I don't speak French. It's terrible. So I've stolen one of the cuttings from the second class session, which Professor assures me is something like what I do. So I want to talk about environment as a resource for intersubjectivity. If you read that title, if we had a conversation. And I said to my talk, the top of my talk, the embodiment as a resource for intersubjectivity. You didn't really understand them, as you probably don't. What are some of the ways in which you might try to ask me what that meant? Ordinary conversational ways. Nobody's going to have a go. Well, you could say, what, right? That would be a good start. Or you could say, what do you mean by embodiment? But there's another really, really, really common thing people do when they don't understand. What? Oh, yeah, with the face. But something else?
Experimental.
I'm asking a different question. I'm asking if you didn't understand this in conversation, what you might do normally to query what it meant, just in ordinary conversation.
Can you explain what you mean?
Yeah, so that's good. That would be one example. Okay, I mean, I'll tell you what I'm thinking. I'm thinking repetition. So people just say the same thing back to you if they don't get it quite often, right? So if I say to my students, you need to do a two-way analysis of variance, and they say to me, yes, I need to do a two-way analysis of variance, that means they don't understand, typically, right? That's a signal of misunderstanding. So I'll come back to that point. Right, embodied interaction. This is presumably not controversial here, but it's sort of controversial in some ways in psychology. Embodied conversation is the native habitat for human interaction, for language, for gesture, and all those things. That's where you first encounter it, that's where you learn it, that's where you deploy it. Before you get text, before you see words on a screen, all of those things, you do this. And there are a variety of interesting non-speech resources for interaction in embodied conversation. You've got body position, body orientation, gesture spaces, the positions where people put their gestures, gaze, facial expression, objects, the actual environment itself, the physical stuff that's around you, and the space, right? So one of the things that people, have thought about for a very long time, actually, is how is that organised? So people who are interested in rhetoric used to do these brilliant, actually, diagrams of the sort of positions where you should gesture to make certain rhetorical effects. So it's like a very interesting way of mapping out how to persuade people. But clearly it's sort of body-centric, speaker-centric, monologue-oriented. Right? It's about me delivering some speech or some persuasive argument. Oh, I should say, I'm very happy to have interruptions. Right? This doesn't have kind of the performative quality of some of the stuff, but we could interact. Here's another example. This is Efron, one of the first people to sort of do systematic studies of gesture and conversation. These are the gestures of Italian and Jewish New Yorkers, a sort of composite. You get a real flavour of what was going on. Again, the thing I'm really just pointing to is there's no addressee here. This is just the speaker. And this is... have you seen these before? These are David McNeil's things. And every time I look at them, I think he's been shooting something. But actually, these are not bullet wounds. These are the places where the gestures have occurred. And he kind of maps it, at least in this work. This was somebody gesturing to camera, telling a story. And this was the positions where the gestures went. So there's an interesting whether they're in the centre or on the periphery. So... all of that is just a long way around of saying there's a load of cognitive individualistic approaches to what embodiment contributes to interaction, particularly in gesture, and there are stories about aiding speech production. So Butterworth has this, I love these things, so when you're trying to find a word, you go, Right, that's a Butterworth. That one. And then people like McNeil talk about the production elements of trying, when you're trying to talk about something that has some imagistic and some kind of lexical content, symbolic content, there are ideas about how those might be integrated in the production. And that leads to certain kinds of hypotheses. So there's this hand-in-hand hypothesis in the literature, which is if these things are truly integrated, then you should only see global adjustments. You should either do more speech and more gesture, or less speech and less gesture. And then there's another set of people who talk about trade-offs. I can't do it with my speech, so I do it with my hands, or the other way around. Which is all good. However, it's not about interaction, and I'm interested in interaction. And in fact, this whole talk is essentially a plea to think about interaction in a more complex way. So how do we use embodiment as a resource for intersubjectivity? How do we actually deploy gestures as part of a dynamic exchange? How do we deploy embodiment? I'm not just talking about gestures, I'm talking about, you know, all of it. And the sort of, I guess the standard story in the literature is this sort of story, which is that we exploit the fact that we're embodied to create empathic understanding of some sort by mimicry. The salient thing is that the body configurations are more or less similar. I should say I'm going to complain a lot about this. I don't agree. I'm just illustrating the idea. The first people to put this together in a kind of systematic review of the literature were Giles Coupland and Coupland, and they talked about accommodation, alignment, and attunement, all of different ways of saying there's something about sort of matching, which is characteristic of successful or effective interactions. They were quite sophisticated about their discussion of this because they said it was moderated by social factors. So you do it more if you like somebody and less if you don't. And it happens in different ways across different modalities, but things like speech rate, posture, accent, and facial expression all tend to converge. That's the, you know, basic idea. If it's working well, you'll converge. Of course, you can converge and it not be working well, or, you know, not necessarily affiliative. And this kind of, you know, manifest physical similarity in the overt behaviours has led a lot of people to talk about possible neural substrates for this, right? Because the mirror neuron, the alleged mirror neuron, I should say, because I don't think it's ever been demonstrated in the human brain. But there's this idea that there's a nice, simple, brain-based account of how this could come about, and then people, Iacoboni, talk about resonance and things like that, so you're sort of matching each other. So, to be specific, emotional contagion, that's Hatfield and Rapson. People, the point of these quotes is that it's just a, you know, I really have to establish just how strong these claims are. Right? They say, automatically and continuously, we automatically and continuously mimic and synchronize movements, with facial expressions, voices, postures, movements, and instrumental behavior of others. And then in a slightly different line of argument, but fundamentally the same idea, I believe. Charlton and Barge, perception behaviour link. Perception of another's behaviour, whatever it is, increases the tendency for the perceiver to behave in a similar manner. This is an entirely passive and non-conscious phenomenon. It's automatic. It's by default. You don't have a choice. Behavioural mimicry is ubiquitous and engaged in automatically. So we should all be doing it all the time. And then this is just a sort of a much more sophisticated psychological processing model of that same idea, in which the people who talk about the sort of neural implementations of motor actions have this very interesting point that, well, actually the point is you can't tickle yourself. That's where all this comes from, because it's too predictable. You know what you're going to do, right? Only somebody else can tickle you properly. So, but the reason, or the, you know, the explanation for that is that whenever you're producing an action, you have something which makes you do the action, and then you have this perception of what you've done, and that's compared to something which is already mimicking what it should look like when you've done it. So there's this idea of an efferent copy. So, you know, as I'm planning to pick up the microphone, before I even do it, I'll have a sort of percept ready of what it should look like when I've got hold of it. That's the idea. So that's a really well established model of action. And then what Pickering and Garrett do is essentially say that works across people. So there's a speaker above the line and an addressee below the line. And what the addressee doing is essentially producing an afferent forward action copy of what the utterance is likely to be. So as you're talking, or gesturing, or whatever, I will be sort of in advance simulating how it's supposed to come out, be making those predictions. And the value of this kind of thing is, for example, people are extremely quick at turn taking. That's, the median gap between turns and conversation is 0 milliseconds, right? Well, 0 to 200. So you have to explain how that's possible. Right? And this is one way to explain it. It's because you are already predicting ahead what's going to come, and therefore you can have your response ready. Okay, and then there's a few things I want to say about the evidence for this kind of view, but this is the study that everybody seems to know, Trashing the World, where they did experiments in which a confederate, a sort of actor, somebody in league with the experiments, would sit in a waiting room. A participant would come in, they'd be told that something was going to happen afterwards, but actually the manipulation was that the person in the waiting room was doing the stuff. And one of the things they would do would be to either systematically rub their nose or shake their foot while talking. And what they showed was that, both strangers, only minimal interaction, but if the confederate rubs the nose, the naive participant who doesn't know what's going on is more likely to rub their nose. Mm-hmm. And if the confederate shakes the foot, the other participant is more likely to shake their foot. That's enough. Right, now, why am I sceptical about this? I'm sceptical because about the automaticity claim. So this is... actually, I just like the pictures. It is going to be relevant slightly, but really this is just about... This guy has an amazing face, doesn't he? So this is Duchenne's original study of facial expressions, where essentially electrocuted people to check which muscles were involved in which facial expression. So can you see the wires? There's wires hanging off.